Nurses and Hypochondriacs, the podcast that brings nurse experts, patients, and hypochondriacs together to discuss hot topics in healthcare. And here is your host, Ercilia Pompilio.
Can you imagine being pregnant and having to have a C-section with no anesthesia? That's what's happening in Gaza. And a recent New York Times article headline read, "A horror film, Mothers in Gaza on Giving Birth in a War Zone." On this episode of the Nurses and Hypochondriacs podcast, my very special guest and former UCLA classmate joins me to discuss maternal child health in Gaza. This is a really interesting episode and you won't want to miss it. But first, a word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Rogue Nurse Media, 501c3, and The Well-Written Nurse, empowering nurses and patients to tell their stories. Welcome to the Nurses and Hypochondriacs podcast, my friend Hoda Shaki.
Hello. Thank you for having me. It's nice to connect, Ercilia.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. I mean, can you believe it's going to be almost 20 years since we graduated from UCLA? It just feels like yesterday to me. I mean,
it really does.
Oh my gosh. I can't believe so much time has like passed.
And we're still so young.
I know, right? We're aging backwards, like yes. Benjamin Button. So glad. I mean, I've loved your LinkedIn posts that you've been posting ever since October, ever since the war in Gaza has broken out. But before we get to all of that, tell us about yourself.
Sure. Well, thank you. And thanks for inviting me to share about this. So I would like to start back when we were in PNP school together at UCLA. And I always admired how you were a person with a voice and you weren't afraid to use it. And it didn't matter if what you had to say was the popular thing or not, but if it was the right thing, you said it. And I always I loved your courage. And so I feel like I'm coming full circle because I've always been sort of a quiet pediatric nurse who, you know, just really wanted to help families and make a difference in communities, and worked as a PNP for many years and always with underserved communities. So I love community clinics. That's my place to work. I think I have an affinity for people of color. I didn't realize at the time why, but now I know exactly why. Minorities like to flock together because there's a shared experience. And so through all the work that I've done in community clinics and learning from families, I've really understood what inequities mean, what social justice means, and how social determinants of health impact everything around a family's health. And so it's kind of propelled me to find my voice, because when I'm in a room, now I do consulting, but when I'm in a room, I bring those families with me. I bring those experiences that I heard from them with me into the room because they're not being represented, whether it's Latino patients or other immigrants, people in immigrant communities or people of color, Black community, and now my people. And so I guess I am a pediatric nurse practitioner who has found her voice and has allowed that to lead me into different pathways that I never thought I'd be taking.
I love it. Thank you so much. And you did take my class during COVID, and your kids, this is what I loved so much about it, how your kids were there to listen to your stories and be your audience, and also your husband, right? They were there to listen to you, which was so great and so fun. But thank you for that. I know I see my life as my own personal screenplay, and I am the main character. So I do like to be that disruptor and ask the questions, even if I look dumb, even if the question is wrong, you know, I always look at that because I feel that people, and nowadays, I mean, I'm living in a different city now, which is a mostly elderly population in Palm Springs, California. And I'm seeing how people are very, very stuck in one point of view, which is scary to me. Because, you know, it almost reminds me of the movie Jaws, where the police chief is like, there's a shark, there's a shark. And then the mayor was all like, no, but we need to keep everything open because it's 4th of July. We need to make money, you know, but it's like nobody's listening to the police chief and ultimately people get eaten. Right. I do feel that way a lot of times, but I've learned to kind of deal with it. And I know that it's almost like we're in a simulation. We're playing a video game and you got to go to the next level. Like, you're like, okay, this person didn't work. So what else do I need to do? I got to write a letter to this person, or I found this out, so I got to do this. And usually it works out. It's mostly to bring awareness to everybody, you know. If it works, it works. And if it doesn't, it's okay. I'm like, okay, that wasn't my fight to fight, you know, and I'm not going to expend any more energy doing it and stuff. And I kind of work with energy and see where the doors start to open, you know, but it's mostly about myself and getting myself to be heard, you know, and it frustrates me when people don't hear me and stuff, but you know, it's cool and stuff. It is me like making myself be heard and having stricter boundaries with what I need and what I need to get done. Cause sometimes people don't respect that. So you got to gently put it again. So, but yeah.
I love those analogies. Those are definitely words to live by. I mean, it's true. Not everybody's going to recognize the shark and some people will get eaten. And you did your part. And if that's their choice to not listen and to not believe and to live in the alternate reality that they want to, you did your part. And that's just very wise. And it's admirable that you don't give up, right? You just continue to be who you are and continue to speak your truth regardless of how it's received. But, you know, you can sleep at night knowing that you said or did what you know was right.
Exactly. We were just talking about your boys too and how they've been advocates and they've turned into advocates as well, which I think is amazing. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So, you know, we can jump right into this conversation about race. I think, you know, a lot happened during COVID. And one of the things that was a huge factor in me finding my voice was taking that class with you, for sure. And the other one, sadly, was the murder of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think what that did for me personally was that it put to words an understanding of my own experience growing up in this country. I was born and raised here, but have always been made to feel un-American because I happen to follow a religion that I believe in and chose to cover my hair and practice it. But when we learned so much about race and racism through the Black Lives Matter movement, and what I realized is while it's happening to the Black community the worst and it's atrocious, it's the same story that's happened to all the minorities that have been oppressed historically, both in this country and others, but specifically in this country. I was able to put to words sort of my own experience and really feel like, no, I need to be an advocate for my own community, number one. And number two, I also realized that as we look at the Black Lives Matter movement, I myself have privileges. So while, yes, I was, you know, mistreated many times and continue to be, and you can spot the racism from 10 miles away, that's nothing compared to what the Black community has gone through. And despite, you know, how I've been treated, I still have a ton of privileges. And how I started to ask myself, how am I using my privilege to speak up for communities of color? And so we had a lot of conversations like that at home with my children. And I think, you know, they're at the age where they've embraced it, and it's not about us or them or which community that needs to, you know, is demanding justice. It's a human, it's a pattern that's being applied to all different people to serve a certain role so that, you know, some folks can get ahead and others do not. And so last year we had the chance to go to our religious trip. So we went to Mecca and Medina, like a mini Hajj. It wasn't Hajj. It was a different time of year, so they don't call it Hajj. But it actually had a third piece of it, which was to go to Jerusalem. And I remember thinking like, oh, is this safe to go? And the boys, and like what might happen to them because they're young teens. And I prayed about it and it was the best decision of our life. It was truly a life-changing experience because we got to just be in this in Jerusalem, which despite all of the occupation and the military, you know, involvement everywhere and the threats to lives of Palestinians, it was also the most peaceful place on earth. And I think all of us were just so drawn to the land and so drawn to the people. It was incredibly life-changing because there was just that juxtaposition between like the presence of violence, the presence of threat, the knowing that you can lose your life at any moment, and also at the same time, the most tremendous peace that you've ever felt. And so when we would walk in and out of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, you'd have to kind of go through the gates, and the Palestinians that lived in that area where we stayed, actually the hotel was owned by Palestinians, they were right across the street from the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They had never gone inside to pray. They're not allowed because they're Palestinian.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we were, because we had American passports, but the Al-Aqsa Mosque is guarded by soldiers, Israeli soldiers, with huge rifles. And they were like babies, Ursula. They looked
very
18,
young.
19 year olds, just standing around together, like chatting it up. And then as we're walking by, they've like got their rifles held and they're just looking at each of us and they just decide who they want to pull aside. So they always go for the teenage boys. And so the first time we went in to pray, I saw them pull a 12-year-old kid to the side. And his dad was like, "Hey, that's my son." And they're like, "You stay out of this." And they questioned the kid just to mess with him. They let him go. I was traumatized for the whole day. I was like, "I can't be here. I need to go." I was like shaking all day. Next thing, I'm like just observing the people around me. And they have such resilience and such strength and such lack of fear, because they already know they could be shot and killed at any moment. So when you know that your life is dispensable like that, you live your life to the fullest. They're the most loving, generous, kind people that I've ever met. And so I started to look at them and see like, okay, you know, they're not acting like we're under, you know, they're not panicking. So why am I? Next time we go in to pray, it's my son's turn. And of course, like he's 17. So he's like this tough guy. He does martial arts. So he thinks he can like defend himself. He's like, "I'm not afraid to die, Mom." And next thing I know, he's looking them in the eye and they pull him aside. And they're like harassing him. And like, he waits a few seconds and then he's like, "I'm American." And he pulls out his passport and they let him go. And literally it became like the pattern of our trip. Every time we went walking, like we would walk and they would pull him aside and try to intimidate him. And then they let him go because he had a US passport. But talk about privilege. So when we came back, we were like, we live in the country that spends billions of US tax dollars to fund Israel's military. And we saw the occupation with our own eyes. We saw, you know, how Palestinians were treated. We'd get pulled over at stops on our tours. And the soldiers would come in and like pull the Palestinians out just to, you know, throw their weight around. We saw soldiers chasing kids because the kids were throwing rocks, but it was like this cat and mouse game where the kids were like all together and they'd throw the rock and then the soldiers would put up their shields and then they would chase after them with their guns. And then the kids would like run away and then they'd come back. So we saw all of this and we made it out because we were American. And I think what happened is when we came back and we saw how much of our tax dollars go in the billions, actually since 1999, the US had signed a pact with Israel to send $2.67 billion a year minimum. And then it went up in 2019 to $3 billion. And we know with this last issue that happened in October, Biden wanted to send $14.8 billion in a package. I think he sent a big chunk, but I forgot how much. And then the second supplement was the 14. And that's the one that's been held up because it involved Ukraine, but it also involved building the wall. And this was just like this weird way that he was trying to get this bill, this package of money being sent to Israel. So we know that all of these, you know, Israel's occupation of Palestine is being funded by the U.S. And so here we come back to this country that we live in and like are enjoying all these privileges with our beautiful home and our safe life. And I think all of us realize that the privilege we have is that we have free speech in this country. and that we can speak up and that we can change hearts and minds and we can tell a different narrative than what doesn't get put on the screen. And with social media, it's just been an explosion of just access to information, what's actually happening. And so to go back to your question about my son, he's 17 and he's fearless. He talks about Palestine at school and he's staged walkouts and he's, you know, helping coordinate protests and he's speaking up and he's going to our city council in Huntington Beach. If anybody knows Huntington Beach, which is the city of people that refused to wear masks during COVID, and very, you know, high population of MAGA supporters. My son went and spoke in front of the city council talking about the importance of recognizing that Palestinian lives are being killed too, not just the hostages in Israel. So I think my job is done passing down that, you know, 4 years ago, I didn't know what it meant to use your privilege. And now we're put in a position where each of us has a privilege. And if we're not using our privilege to speak up for human life, then we're not fulfilling our whole obligation on this earth. I mean, you do it every day, Ursilia, through your work and when you ask questions and when you talk to people. But all of us need to be doing it. It's not just because I was Arab or that I went to Palestine. It's a humanitarian issue. The same, you know, occupation that's happened in Palestine is the same story that happened to the First Nations in the US. It's the same occupation story. It's the same tale narrative of you know, calling people savages. Let's, you know, start there by calling people savages and dehumanizing them. And then let's talk about the narrative of feeling like this is our manifest destiny to be here. And then there's the narrative of everybody wants us dead and we're victims and we're under threat. And if we don't get rid of these savages so that we can live peacefully in this land that belongs to us, then they're going to obliterate us. And all of that is just not true. I mean, Muslims and Christians and Jews have lived in Israel peacefully for a long time, up until 1948, when that land was given to Israel. So the narratives aren't always true, but it's become embodied and people really, I think, are afraid of Arabs and Muslims. You know, and 9/11 only helped with that, right? To create this narrative of fear that, you know, Muslims want the West dead. No, they don't. They just want their land back. They just want to be able to travel freely in their land. So that was a long, you know, little piece that I wanted to get.
I love it. That was so well said. I had my former guests on who were UFO people. So they had been visited. And what they said was, and we talked about the media and portrayal of stuff, and whoever controls the media, it just really controls the narrative. And I hope people understand that they don't believe everything they're watching, you know. And yeah, I mean, TikTok has been great with that as well. People sharing their own personal stories of what is going on and what is happening, like in Gaza. I was watching, I think it was on TikTok. It was a young pediatrician who went over. She's an American. So she was working at one of the hospitals and she had said, "Here I am doing breastfeeding, teaching with a brand new mom while there's bombs outside." I mean, can you just imagine? It's just absolutely crazy. The war basically started in October, early October of this year, right? And in September, I had the opportunity to meet this international criminal attorney from Jerusalem, right? And I actually met him on Bumble and he, you know, was in town. I was in Pasadena at the time and he was in town working for a client. And we had just connected. I was like, "Oh, come eat at this pizzeria." He's like, "I really wanted to meet you because I listened to your podcast." Mm-hmm. I was like, "Oh, cool." And I, you know, he sent me his Wikipedia page and he was a very, very fascinating person. So I remember we went to he wanted to go to the museum the next day. So we went to the LACMA And he's a really great historian of art. I learned so much from him because we talked about mythology and how mythology plays such a big role in, you know, our society, which we don't really pay attention to. You know, everything is based in myth. And he had gone to Cambridge to school, I believe, and in London. And he had said that, you know, he had to take a specifically mythology class and give orations, like that's what he was tested on, you know, which was very, very fascinating to me, because a lot of the things that I see, like intuitively, comes in myths, you know, and I have to look them up, which is very interesting. So it was fascinating to me. I contacted him when I heard what had happened, because he has three children. And I was like, are you guys okay? You know, and he's like, there's bombs, there's the raids every day. Can you imagine just living like that? It's like, talk about privilege, you know? And he was just, you know, telling me the scene of what was going on, and how everything was, you know, so changed and very scary for everybody, you know? And then he sends me this link. Cause I go, oh, you know, what are you working on? And he goes, oh, this is my new client. And this happened like a day before, I think,
October 7th.
October 7th. Wow. And so what had happened is he sends me that one of his clients, from New York is Jewish and went to one of the museums and knocked down one of the Roman statues, a specific one. And you could see the head on the floor in the link that I sent you. She's Athena, which is in Roman, the Romans. So in Greek, she is Athena, goddess of war. The Romans saw her as Minerva, and California sees her as Eureka. So Eureka is, this is the symbol of California. Right. And it all stems from Athena, Minerva, Eureka. So they are the goddesses of war. So I was just so fascinated how this guy just chops off her head and then this whole thing erupts. So I was like, that's crazy. Look at the symbolism. You know, of course, he really didn't see it. I go, you like myth? I go, this is so wild. You know, it's like, what is going on there? You know, and, I think he called it religious fanaticism, because he says that when people go to Jerusalem, they kind of have this mental psychotic episodes or so. He's really great at creating psychological diagnoses, because on his Wikipedia page, like all his clients have like something. And I'm like, you're not, I was like, how are you diagnosing these people, you know, with, and he would just, they just create these terms and they make the client fit that term, you know, that diagnosis. And I guess they get a doctor to like, you know, diagnose them, but it was very, very fascinating to me. I'm like, this is pretty wild, but
I mean, I think it puts, you know, as humans, our comfort zone is to put people in boxes. So if we can put a diagnosis or a label or an explanation for why they're acting the way they're acting, we feel better about it, especially if it fits the narrative that's been passed down to us, or maybe the myth that's been passed down to us from our families that may or may not be true. I think, you know, one of the myths, and I'll let you continue, but one of the myths is that the war started in October 7th. And really it started when Palestine was occupied in 1949, because for the past 75 years, I mean, like I said, like Muslims, Arabs and Jews have been living peacefully for a very, very long time. But when that land was taken from Palestinians and given to the Jews, it became an occupation. And so more and more land was taken, and Palestinians were forced into these areas like the West Bank or Gaza. And so it's not like they're living side by side peacefully. There's, you know, constant lack of access to healthcare. There's constant kidnapping of children. There's military courts. So children who get like arrested, which I don't know why children get arrested, because we're talking young children. not just teens, but they get tried in military courts, whereas what? Israeli citizens do not. Right.
That is so crazy.
If you're Palestinian, you're not allowed into Jerusalem without passing like multiple checkpoints and getting permission. And it can take 5 hours to go a trip that's a 45-minute trip because you're Palestinian, you have to be stopped at checkpoints. So it's not, you know, when you talk about war, it's war is understood as like two neighboring countries fighting. But these are people whose land has been occupied and they're living under very oppressive apartheid, like racist rules that just have not been seen on TV. And so they're fighting back, they're resisting, just as, you know, Native Americans were resisting occupation in the US, and we called them savages and we put them in reservations and we killed their buffalo to starve them to death and to like wipe them out until they were weak enough to be, you know, subdued. This is a Palestinian resistance issue. It's not a war. It didn't start on October 7th. Palestinians are just trying to gain whatever rights they have back. They're not allowed to leave Gaza, right? So they keep being pushed to different places that are safe, but it's not like they can get on planes and leave or get on ships and leave. They can't leave. They're in a, it's essentially an open air prison. And then we can get into the whole like health access discussion. But when people refer to it as war, it's dangerous because it brings a lot of assumptions that aren't there. It's not two countries, two militaries fighting each other. It's people just trying to like resist in order to survive. And they happen to love their land enough to be willing to die in it.
Yeah, it's pretty tragic. I mean, I can't even imagine just going through all that. And I've been watching it on TikTok. I've been watching it on YouTube. It's always on the news. But let's talk about the impact on the maternal child health. I mean, like I explained about that story, but what else is going on that you know of?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think from a health perspective, it's devastating. And it also, makes it pretty clear why this is a genocide. Because when you've got 2 million people who are trapped in Gaza, in all different parts of Gaza is being bombed, including the majority of the hospitals. We know that there's about 50,000 pregnant women in Palestine. One of the things about Palestinians is they love their land, but they also love their families and their people, and they're fearless when it comes to, you know, risking like sacrificing their own life so that their offspring can continue to live. And so because of that, they have a lot of kids. Palestinians have a lot of kids. So it doesn't surprise me that there are, you know, so many pregnant women right now. There's about 50,000. And because of what's happening, they have lack of access to food, lack of access to water. We know that many of the hospitals have been bombed. A majority of the hospitals have been bombed. The miscarriage rate has gone up 300%.
Wow.
So because of the fear, because of the lack of food, because of the tragedy of having to bury their own children, like they're delivering prematurely. And because hospitals aren't safe, they have to make the choice. Do I deliver at home under uncertain conditions, or even in the rubble, right? Whatever's left of home or in somebody else's home or in some school, or do I go to the hospital and risk, you know, very unsanitary conditions? I don't know if you've seen pictures, but like,
yeah, people, for sure.
There's no gurneys, people are on the floor, very unsanitary conditions, or being bombed, right? So it's a risk to go to the place that's supposed to be the safest place for you, which is the hospital. And we've heard lots of stories of women having C-sections without anesthesia. Like, how? My mom just broke her hip, and the amount of pain that she was in, and she just kept getting morphine and different meds to alleviate her pain. And I couldn't even imagine, like, how do you have a C-section with no anesthesia? Or they're delivering at home. And right now, a lot of the mothers are afraid to drink water because there's so much waterborne diarrhea because, oh, wow, again, there's no sanitary conditions. So they're not drinking water. So of course they're going to miscarry even more or deliver these premature unhealthy infants. And then because of the starvation, they can't even produce enough milk for their babies. So we always talk about, you know, emergency preparedness and supporting lactation, you know, to like as a way to mitigate starvation of infants during a crisis. But like if they're starving, they can't even produce their milk. And of course, because nothing can come in and out of Gaza, so they can't access formula. So they're delivering babies and basically having to watch them die. And then what the one statistic I just came across, I think last week, that I want to share and then I'll stop, is that if you count the number of children who have been killed from 2019 to 2022, worldwide in conflicts, it's about 12,193. And that's over, do the math real quick, that's over 3 years. From October to February, the number of children that have been killed in Gaza alone is 12,300. So wow. Already passed. Yeah.
That's insane. So a ceasefire, you know, this morning, you were bringing up the hospitals and my parents are here visiting me and they have the TV onto the news. And one of the hospitals that got raided because they had underground tunnels. And I think this morning, President Biden was going to be talking to Benjamin Netanyahu. Then we have Trump saying I could get a ceasefire. What's going on? I mean, what can we do as Americans to push for a ceasefire?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you so much. So I think, you know, and I have friends who are Jewish. There's a pediatrician who's Jewish. She wrote an article with me. So this isn't at all, I just want to put this out there before we close. Like, this isn't at all like a Muslim versus Jewish or Arab versus Israeli issue. This is a humanitarian issue. And we really, everybody does want to see peace in the Middle East. And a big part of the problem is that the blind sort of support that the US has with supporting Israel and their military, even though they're one of the richest militaries in the world, and the fact that we're spending like billions of our tax dollars to go there is taking away from social justice opportunities in our own nation. Like, we shouldn't even be funding that. And the only way that that's going to stop is if all of us as constituents talk to our congresspeople, our senators. Jewish Voice for Peace has a really awesome link where you go and you enter your address and it will automatically call you and connect you to your congresspeople, your senators. I do it every day. It's part of my routine, as much as I can remember to just call and let them know you don't want your US dollars funding a military occupation. That would be, I think, the first thing. And, you know, what ended apartheid in South Africa was actually U.S. pressure. So when enough Americans felt that it was not okay and Congress made a decision, it ended. So that didn't mean all the white people left South Africa. They're now living there peacefully. So when we say a ceasefire and a permanent ceasefire, where nobody is calling for any harm to any Jewish person ever, it's an end of an occupation. It's an end of an apartheid that we don't want to support with our dollars. Yes, it is possible to leave peacefully, because when people are not occupied and oppressed, they don't need to resist. They're not resisting because they're bad people or they want to kill their Jews. They just want to live like and be treated with human dignity. So I think as Americans, we need to care, number one, like with our hearts, and not follow these narratives like, oh, they're just animals. Because we've seen that before. That's how we've taken the land from Native Americans. That's how Blacks have been enslaved. That's how Latinos continue to be, you know, discriminated against, is that we have to care and not turn away, because our money is funding this. So that's what I'll say.
I love that.
And thank you.
What was the website again that you were saying where people?
Oh, yeah. Jewish Voice for Peace or Jewish Voices for Peace. I forgot which one it was, but it'll pop right up if you Google it.
Very good. And where can people find you on LinkedIn?
Oh, just under my name, Hoda Shawki. I don't know if there are any others. But if you look at some of the posts, you'll recognize it's probably me right away, because I've been sharing. And thank you so much for this opportunity to use my voice, Ursula.
Yeah, we hope to have you on again. Thank you so much, Hoda.
Thank you. It's good to see you. Take care, my friend. Ciao. Right.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Nurses and Hypochondriacs. We hope you've enjoyed the show. And we'd love it if you left us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It totally helps us out. And go ahead and throw us some bucks. Our links to PayPal and Venmo are on our show notes. Thanks again.